One of my favorites was the interview with the guy from Pirate Joe's, who has basically opened up a shadow Trader Joe's up in Vancouver because they don't have ones, you know?
That was good. I really liked your kids playing in the mud in the Ho Rainforest.
It's a cheap shot to put your kids on the radio.
Yeah, but it always works.
Yeah.
What about the guy that went out and played taps every single night?
That guy was like inspiring.
He's still doing it.
So I'm Gabriel Spitzer. I'm here with Kevin Kniestad and Arwin Nix. We're the staff of Sound Effect on KPLU. And this thing that we do at the very beginning of the show, we call it the cold open. I kind of ripped it off from Saturday Night Live. But it's basically just a table setter for the show that week. It gives you a little bit of an idea of what the theme's going to be, what the tone of the show is. And today we're talking about some of our very favorite stories, the ones that are probably the most personal to us. And we're also going to talk about some of our favorite cold opens, because there have been some doozies.
So I'll start. And I want to start with the show that we did about coming out. But in a very Sound Effect way, we started the show with a story about staying in. And Gabe, you went to Mary's Place and you interviewed a seventh grader named Riley. And you talked to him about why he doesn't tell his friends at school and his classmates that he's homeless.
I don't want to get bullied and laughed at, because like they all have their own houses and they all have just stuff that they want, and I don't get that kind of stuff, so they might think that that's funny and stuff like that, so they might not be my friend no more.
So that, to me, was one of the most heart-wrenching moments that we've had on Sound Effect, and it's a story that I have thought about every single day since. And I think that, you know, it illustrates something for me that as the senior producer I really try and get across with the show, which is just broadcasting that we are all people and that we all have a story, and you may not know it, you may not know all of our secrets, but we all have something that's hard for us to deal with. And I really loved how vulnerable everyone was on that episode, but Riley being a seventh grader, I don't know, he just touched me.
Yeah. Thanks for starting us off with heartbreak, Arwin.
Yeah, that's what I'm here for.
Classic, Arwin. Another one I liked a lot was one that kicked off our Lost and Found show. And it was just you and me, Arwin, sitting in the studio, kind of just shooting the breeze about things that we lose a lot. I mean, we both have this sort of habitual bad habit of
losing
losers. Certain things. We are losers.
We are losers.
Of things. And in particular, you are a loser of a wallet, a particular wallet that has been lost and come back and lost and come back many, many, many times, including this time.
Losing that wallet during Gay Pride one year at the Cuff, I never thought I was going to get it back. And not only did I get it back from a really nice leather daddy, but it had all the money in it.
And that kind of restores your faith in humanity a little bit.
Every single time it does.
So I love this for a few reasons. Number one, I love it for the text that my father sent me the next day that said, "Great show. What exactly is a leather daddy?"
So my question is, what was your response?
I think I told him to look it up on Urban Dictionary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm just going to assume that he did, because we have never discussed it since then.
Gabriel's father, if you want to know what a leather daddy is, just give me a call. We can talk for hours.
I'm certain of that. But the other thing I really like about it is that it does get into a kind of, you know, we can be a dark show, but I think that there is a faith in humanity that kind of shines through in a lot of cases. And that story of how your wallet came back to you over and over and over again because of the kindness of strangers, that really kind of stuck with me too.
I need to take this turn because we're sort of pseudo picking on her right now.
Oh yeah,
might as well keep this trend
pseudo.
Going.
No, this is actual hazing.
I work for her, and it's so rare I get these opportunities. So for our age show,
Oh yes,
Arwin, you and Gabriel went out to a park to talk about swings and why kids love to swing and why adults don't love to swing. And as we're kind of progressing through this cold open, it turns out that Arwin doesn't just dislike swings, it cripples her.
They make me feel like a grown-up baby. And I honestly feel like I'm going to cry just thinking about it, because I hate it so much. It makes my blood feel like it's flowing in the wrong direction. But more than anything, I just feel like I'm doing life wrong.
Doing life wrong is Arwin's reaction to swings. Doing life wrong.
It's true.
This is like one of the most talented senior producers in the country, and swings make her feel like she's doing life wrong.
Well, I mean, She is a grown-up baby.
You grown-up baby.
Okay, I'm going to take it back here for a second. Right. And bring us back down, because that is what I like to do. So this next story is another story, and it's kind of a redemption story. And this one actually hits the mark on all the things I really love. Stories of struggle, stories about faith, stories about changing your mind and realizing and learning something about yourself, and gay stuff. And this is actually from the cold open you did with Ryan Meeks, who is the pastor at the Eastlake Community Church in Bothell. And it this was about him coming out and deciding to have a policy to be completely inclusive of the LGBTQ community, which didn't go over well with some other Christians.
Honestly, I think I was afraid. In my world, I've seen what happens to people who come out for full inclusion. And so I was probably afraid. So much had changed in my heart. I mean, I'm not the same person I was 5 years ago. I actually find it hard to put myself in that place and imagine how that guy used to think. What was way more of a concern to me was being true to myself, regardless of the fallout or what kind of consequences came that way, because the worst thing to do would be to live untrue.
That was a really powerful conversation with Ryan Meeks. He's a young guy who didn't set out to sort of be the guy that he is. I mean, he sort of called it his church an accidental mega church or something like that at one point.
Yeah.
And he is, it's been a continual kind of process of figuring out how to do that intentionally. Mm-hmm. And this was a little glimpse into a moment of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was really great. Another one that I really, really appreciated was a chat we had not too long ago with former Mayor Mike McGinn. We dragged him in here to talk about etiquette for our show on etiquette. I think, you know, many political observers have thought that Mike had a little bit of tone deafness about etiquette.
A little bit.
And during at least the beginning of his term, and he cops to that pretty well. But in the process of serving as mayor and coming up against what it means to be Seattle Nice, he came out with a little bit of understanding, a little bit of insight into the character of the essential character of the Northwest. And this is him explaining a bit of that.
To those of you new to Seattle, when somebody says to you, have you ever considered X? You may think they're asking you, have you ever considered X? What they're actually doing in Seattle is saying, this is what I think.
So McGinn's point was just kind of, you know, that he learned how to speak the language a little bit after a while. And that whole show was really a critical examination of what it means to be so-called Seattle Nice, which is a little passive aggressive, a little phony. And I think one of the things we have tried to do with this show is to cut through a lot of that and get to some pretty real stuff underneath the surface. And when we're at our best, that is what we're doing.
And speaking of powerful things that go beneath the surface, we also did a toilet show. And sometimes I think you just need a laugh. And there were a lot of really interesting and some serious stories in our toilet show. But at the beginning, we got to have a good laugh. You and our then intern, Bree Ripley, Gabriel, went into separate bathrooms at a restaurant and called each other on the telephone and read the graffiti on the walls to each other.
Luck helps along the path. Persevering keeps you upon it.
You sprinkle when you tinkle. Please be neat, sweetie, and wipe the seat. Love you.
All right, well, you're sort of stuck with us for the hour here. We are going to be bringing you some of our favorite stories. Now, we've done shows where we've talked about some of our favorites in the past. A lot of those stories are, in some ways, the story of someone's life changing in an important or profound way. And I think these stories are nearest and dearest to us in the way, and maybe they've changed us a little bit, too. So that's all coming up on Sound Effect. Don't go away. First up today is a story that originally came to my attention when I was doing another story. I had gotten to know this young girl who was 4 years old when she was diagnosed with cancer. She had a tumor on her eye, and eventually she had the eye removed and replaced with a prosthetic eye. And her mother explained to me a little bit about how they created that eye. Her mother, who had been through so much, when she was talking about this, her eyes kind of lit up because it was so fascinating to her, the way that they actually went about creating a prosthetic eye, how personal and intimate and loving this process was. And so I found the people who did that. They're based in Kirkland, Washington. What I found out was far more interesting than I could have possibly predicted. So I talked to them off and on for about a year, did a number of interviews with them, and in the end, we produced this story on Sound Effect that aired in the spring. So here it is. Todd Cranmore makes eyes for people who have lost or damaged their eyes because of accidents or cancer or birth defects.
I'm a licensed ocularist, and ocularist is an artificial eye maker.
And if you assume that prosthetic eyes are made with 3D scanners and lasers and stuff like I did, think again.
All of our process is hand done. It's done with the patient right in front of us, just a few inches away. My eyeballs are glued to their eyeballs and trying to pick out the colors and the patterns.
That turns out to be very difficult. It's part art, part science. Todd studies the patient's remaining eye, if there is one, and tries to perfectly match the delicate patterns with his paintbrush.
We have cobalt blue.
The colors French get stacked in layer after layer, a hundred or more of them in just one iris.
Building all the way from the back to the front. So we start adding texture and color and actually depth.
This is a pretty specialized profession. There's just 4 licensed ocularist practices in Washington. There's no school, they all learn through apprenticeship. And they're all trying to capture this most mysterious part of human anatomy.
There's nothing else on our bodies that are that captivating. Kind of like a flower, it's a beacon, it's the life, it's the windows of the soul. What a challenge to try to duplicate an iris and try to make something that is plastic and pigment look alive.
That plastic, specifically acrylic, is what prosthetic eyes are made of. Todd says most people ask him if they're made of glass. The answer is, not since World War II.
Another question is how I got into the field, and that's a pretty common question.
And that's a long answer for you.
That can be a long answer.
That answer starts with the other 2 main characters in this story.
Yes, my name's Christy Erickson. I'm an ocularist. Todd Cranmore is my son. Timothy Cranmore, patient, is my son.
My name is Tim Cranmore, and I'm the brother of Todd Cranmore and the son of Christy Erickson.
How Christy and Todd went into business together making eyes goes back to a summer day in 1976. The family was living in a rural area just outside of Monroe, Washington. Todd was just a year and a half old. His big brother Tim was 3. Baby Colleen was just 2 weeks.
It was near 4th of July because we were having a party.
We had a family gathering at our house.
It's about mid-afternoon, and my husband and his brother.
And my dad and my uncle went to go work out on the tractor.
We had a backhoe.
And of course, being a young boy, I wanted to go out with them.
Tim was just playing outside, just watching, sitting on the ground watching.
I remember him saying, no, stay here, and I put up a pretty big fuss that I wanted to go out, so they finally agreed to let me go out and watch.
And it had a bolt on it that they were trying to take off with these great big old bolt cutters.
Apparently they were using some bolt cutters to cut a bolt off the tractor.
And so when they ended up cutting this bolt, and the bolt flew right in his eye.
It ricocheted off and skimmed the edge of my eye.
It must have been like a 1 in a bazillion shot.
Right. You know, what are the chances of that tiny piece of metal hitting you right in the eye?
I do remember I was inside with the baby.
I remember him kind of picking me up and looking at me, like all concerned. And I remember looking at him and I saw like a little blood above his eyebrow. So, you know, I was worried about him because I actually saw blood and I couldn't figure out why they were looking at me. I don't remember feeling any pain.
They, of course, did emergency surgery that night. I think it was a Sunday night. The ophthalmologist, the surgeon, he came out and told us that, you know, it was all collapsed and, you know, it looked like something exploded inside of Tim's eye.
At 3 years old, Tim lost vision in his right eye. Christy was afraid he'd forever be bumping into things, he'd never ride a bike, but Tim figured most of that stuff out. He was a resilient kid. Christy's marriage didn't bounce back so well.
The trauma of what happened to Tim was very severe. I was told that when tragedies like this happen, it'll either strengthen a marriage or break it up. And in our case, it broke it up.
By the time Tim was ready to start kindergarten, his eye had shrunk back into its socket. His parents started to worry about how other kids at school would treat him, so someone suggested they look into getting Tim an artificial eye.
I met Gerald Erickson, was the ocularist. I was really impressed with the office. I met patients, and even there was a child. You know, it was just a close, secure feeling to have, to be understood.
Jerry made Tim's first prosthetic, what's called a scleral shell that fits over the withered eye, a cool blue to match the left. And Christy took an immediate interest in the craft of this, and in the craftsman.
I ended up divorcing my first husband and married Jerry Erickson.
Christy became Jerry's office assistant, and then his apprentice, and eventually his colleague. And meanwhile, Tim was growing up, learning to live with a fake eye. That was not always easy.
It would get around, especially in grade school, that this is the guy with the glass eye, and everybody would want to see it, or they want me to take it out. They would give me money to take out the eye. So they would, you know, conjure up a quarter or 50 cents or whatever it was, and I didn't really care what the amount was. It was more of a peer pressure thing. You know, one person would ask, then all of a sudden you'd have this whole group of kids around you waiting for you to take out your eye. So.
Did you hate that? What was that like?
Yeah, I definitely hated it. You know, I didn't want the attention.
Tim still doesn't really like attracting attention. But now he's a handsome professional guy with blonde hair and close-cropped reddish beard. He's been through 7 or 8 eyes since that first one. You have to replace them every few years. And today, Tim is back in the office to sit for a new eye.
Gee, I didn't think there would be room for improvement, but there is room for improvement. What do you have?
Well, it's been a while. I didn't realize how long it's been. We were like, oh, wow, it's 2007, so.
Is that like the cobbler's children don't get?
All those new shoes.
Shoes. Yeah.
Over the years, Tim has had eyes made by his stepdad, his mother, his stepsister, and the last few times by his brother Todd. It's Todd's turn again.
All right, well, let's start painting.
Ready? Have fun, you guys.
In the painting room, the family resemblance is obvious. If you just walked in here, you might think you were looking at two brothers recreating some epic staring contest from their childhood.
It's hard not to laugh or anything. Like, you're looking each other in the eye, and you're supposed to be serious. And, you know, you think of kids like, stop looking at me or don't stare at me.
The process starts with a curved disc of acrylic. This will become the iris.
So I'm getting set up to put your pupil in. What I want to do is set your pupil first, because it's going to be offset, and then all the radial patterns I want to paint out.
Then Todd sets about recreating his brother's steely blue, which turns out to contain hardly any blue at all. It's mostly grays and whites and yellows, all delicately stacked on top of each other.
We're trying to make a 3D effect, because the muscle, the iris, has crypts and it's got peaks and it has all these different folds in it. And so you really don't want to try to create like a wheel. You want it to look like tissue.
The eye also has to be a perfect fit. So Todd takes an impression of Tim's eye socket.
And then if you can, bring your chin up a little higher. Perfect.
Todd injects a gel into the empty socket and lets it harden. It works just like a dental impression.
And you're going to feel the cool come in now. Feel it come in?
Mm-hmm. When he pulls it out, he has a perfect mold of where the new prosthesis will fit.
Now it's just about set up now. You might feel a little bit of a pull on your eyelashes here as this comes out. Great.
Later, Todd will carefully fray red silk thread to make the blood vessels. The effect all this has is to make the prosthesis almost indistinguishable from the natural eye. It's really uncanny. Of course, there are some tells. In the dark, Tim's live pupil dilates while his painted one doesn't. The prosthetic eye doesn't move that much, and Tim is hyper aware of when people notice.
You know, especially when I was younger, talking to girls, I was shy in general, and then if I think they're trying to check out my eye a little bit, I'll be even more shy and kind of back away and kind of distracts me, and that's been a big hurdle to get over.
Sounds like you've been burned once or twice.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've had some, you know, dates in the past where the subject of the eye comes up. You know, I have 5 great dates in a row. Things seem to be going really well. And as soon as they go, oh, what's wrong with your eye? And then I tell them what happened. And that's the last you hear from them.
We tend to think of someone's eyes as such a part of their personhood. When someone's missing one, people can be weird about it. And that's why the process of Todd painstakingly recreating his brother's eye is such an intimate act.
But I feel blessed to have this option.
instead of just wearing a patch over your eye or just being a pirate the rest of your life or something, but kind of nice to be able to just be an everyday person.
Look at that detail. Now, is that a detail, man, or a woohoo?
How's it look to you, Tim?
That looks great.
Does it look familiar?
Yeah, yes.
Christy clearly relishes seeing her sons
That's
together.
Great.
Maybe any mom would, but here, in this office, it feels like putting something back together.
I always just kind of want to revert back to when they shared bedrooms and things, or when they climbed on the roof and found out later. I'm just totally proud.
And to have something taken from you as a young mom and taken from Tim, does this feel like you're restoring it in some way? I mean, it must feel like it's coming full circle.
Yeah, that's a really great way to state it. That satisfied feeling that you get when it's like, who would have thunk it?
Who would have thunk on that July day in 1976 that the family would end up here together, making Tim whole again?
What's up, Todd?
Tim's wearing his eyeball. You can go take a look at him.
Timbo! Whoa! That's beautiful. How's your eye feel?
Definitely feels really good.
For at least the next 5 years or so, this eye will go to sleep with Tim and wake with him. It'll go on dates and droop after long days of work. And yes, probably even cry with him. Tim still has his tear ducts. This eye will be in all the family photos. And that makes sense, because both of his eyes are gifts from his family.
I think it's a neat thing to be able to hand over the mirror and be able to let go and say, here's this thing that we made, and it's my hands, it's my mom's hands, but I want my brother to have ownership and to feel like it is his eye. It is not our eye any longer. It's his eye.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. I'm back in studio here with Kevin Kniestad and Arwin Nix. And just thinking about that story again, that was really a highlight of the year for me. And one of the things I wanted to just mention to you guys is that I've been in touch with them since then, and they're really fantastic people. And they gave me a present. And I'm just going to bring it here to show it to you guys. So, all right. Yeah, it's sort of stuck. So there it is.
Oh, my God.
So they sent me Tim's eyeball.
Oh, wow. This is his actual eyeball that was in his head?
This is the one that they were making during the course of that story.
Oh,
it turned out...
Can I touch it?
Yeah. Yeah. Don't worry. It's not going to hurt him. There was something that that didn't fit quite right or something. They wound up having to remake it. And so they just had a spare. Ordinarily, they keep those around for teaching tools and stuff like that. But they're so incredibly generous with their stories and their time and everything else that they asked me if I wanted to have it.
It's beautiful.
It is. I find it completely mesmerizing. Like I could just stare at it. Like you could stare at a real person's eye and just not look away.
This looks just like a real person's eye. That's amazing.
So I want to thank Todd and Tim and Christy for that very, very much. Thank you for letting us into your lives a little bit. And thank you for this very unique present. If you thought that story was up close and personal, well, the next one is maybe even more so, though in a slightly different way. We are about to immerse ourselves in someone else's love affair, one that goes out in a blaze. That's all up ahead on KPLU's Sound Effect.
Don't go away.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm here with Kevin Kniestad.
Howdy.
And Arwin Nix.
Hello.
And we are talking about some of our very, very favorite stories, stories that affected us most deeply over Sound Effect's first year. And Arwin, you are up.
Okay, so this next story within the office we refer to with just the shorthand of the fire. And we were working on a theme for comfort zone, and I thought, well, how do you seek comfort in a home? Like, and if your house burned down, like, what would be the first thing that you would buy? So I started interviewing all these people who had lost their homes in fires. I came across this story, which kind of like the eye story, is not what I was expecting it to be. And I ended up working on it for months before we knew exactly where we were going to put it. And We ended up putting the story of Amelia Bono and Brian Yeager on the theme, The Point of No Return, and I feel like that's pretty appropriate.
I remember the first time I saw him walk by. He's just a person that you see and you don't forget.
I was bartending at the Lava Lounge, and she was a waitress or a hostess at Mama's, and she used to stalk me.
He's a tall, skinny Jew from Texas with huge brown eyes and the darkest brown eyelashes.
I had a girlfriend. I was completely unaware of her. She would, like, watch me walk up and down the street and kind of was crushing on me from afar.
Eventually, I started going into the Lava Lounge.
She was just young and beautiful and a little crazy. Could tell by the way she was looking at me. She wanted to kiss.
I knew I was in love with Brian after speaking to him 3 times.
One day, I guess she kind of seduced me one day at the Lava Lounge. We ended up staying after.
At the end of the 3rd conversation, he just sort of looked at me and he said, "Why don't you walk down to the end of the bar?" I walked down to the end of the bar and he looked at me and he said, "I want you to kiss me really softly on the lips." And I did.
Emily and I kind of had like the typical, you know, really sexy, heavy few days.
I was the kind of electrified in a way that I think only happens a couple of times in a life. I mean, it was just something I was certain of then and I'm certain of now.
This, something's really happening here. You know what I mean? It was just that kind of, you could feel it. The energy was there, you know? But we didn't plan on being together 6 years, but.
It was absolutely necessary that I make this person realize that we are in love.
It just happened. You know what I mean? Like we knew we were going to fall madly in love with each other. It was just, everything was perfect.
He looked at me and he was like, "All right, I'm going to break up with my girlfriend tonight." And then he said, "Do you steal things?" And I was like, "No." And he walked me into this back closet of the back bedroom, which 4 years later became our bedroom. And he opened up a locked box that was sitting on the floor of the closet. And he took out a copy of The Catcher in the Rye. That was a first edition copy. And he said, "I want you to know that I play music and I always will. And I'm never going to make any money. And when it comes down to it, I'll sell this book, and that's my plan, that's how I'm gonna make it work, but I'm not ever gonna be like a normal guy." And I was like, "All right."
It was never dull. I mean, we were always talking, constantly challenging each other, talking about everything. I loved her brain so much, and I loved just being with her and having her around me and living together and all that. Loved it a lot.
We just instantly started to belong to each other.
She was my best friend, like my absolute best friend.
Describe the house for me physically. What did it look like?
500 West Republican was like probably the most special house in all of Queen Anne.
That house was a total anomaly.
Anybody that saw it, like if you walked in and you saw it, everybody had the same reaction. It was just a magical little spot.
It faced into this forest that was like above Elliott Street.
You can't even see the house from the road. It was right where Republican dead end.
It had a huge deck that wrapped around the back half and was supported by stilts.
With an almost completely unobstructed panoramic view. Beautiful light.
However, I will take credit that I deserve for always feeling a sense of doom about that house.
You would have felt it. Like nobody walked in that house and didn't feel it.
And it wasn't even creepy. It was just like a dark power that this house had.
Did you ever see Evil Dead? You know, it kind of looked like that.
And it was so isolated. Like we could sit in the yard, in the front yard in our underwear, and we could bash the drum kit at 4 a.m. and nobody even knew we were there. Like the UPS guy couldn't find it.
I loved it. I could live in that. I like that kind of energy and magic, you know what I mean? And it's like, if it did spook me, I just wouldn't believe in it. She didn't want to move into it. She was terrified of it.
It was cheap and it was gorgeous. And there was no reason for me to not move in there, but I didn't want to.
It's just funny that we waited so long because I loved living with her so much. And she brought so much life to that house. It was unbelievable. I mean, she painted the walls. which I was like, I never even considered.
I got rid of all of the bad art. I filled it with plants. It worked. Like, we were able to reinvent the emotional blueprint of the house.
Like, it kind of took the evil out a little bit, like the eeriness out of it a little bit. It was still kind of an eerie place because it was just so old.
It still never felt safe to me.
So why did you two break up?
Why did we break up? Oh, that question.
Why did we break up?
At some point about, like shortly after I moved into the house, he joined this band that just was gonna tour all the time, and that is what he's always wanted.
I know 4 or 5 months, it's not that much, but when you spread it out over a year, it was hard for me to be home.
There's no part of me that ever wants to make the person I love feel kept, even if in some ways that means that they are moving away from me, I guess.
I think we just wanted to sleep with other people. I mean, that was just bottom line. Like, we wanted to kiss other people, and it was really confusing and really difficult because I loved her so much.
I just sort of woke up one day and realized that I felt like an independent operator, and I didn't feel like Brian was my person anymore. I felt like I was my person.
It wasn't like you're out of my life or I can't talk to you for a while, or it wasn't like that at all. Like, it wasn't, there wasn't even that desire, you know? It was just, I need to go do other things for a while.
You know, I had fallen in love with him when I was 20 years old, and I needed to be with other people. I needed to have different experiences. I needed to live in a studio apartment with all my own things and have sex with boys and girls and do whatever I wanted and not grow up yet.
I was gonna go on tour, and then when I got back, she was gonna be gone.
I remember just like laying in bed, barely speaking to each other for like 3 days before he left. And then I remember getting out of bed and looking at, like, you know, the garden we had planted, and we were holding hands, and he was just like, Amelia, what are we gonna do with this beautiful house? And I was like, we'll figure that out when you're on tour.
I'm leaving, and she's just sobbing. I mean, just sobbing.
I was like stunned at myself that I had actually made this decision, and I just laid in our bed and just soaked it with my tears.
We're just kissing her and kissing her and kissing her, and she's crying so hard. I mean, I can just, it's like her face is soaking wet. I can taste the tears on her lips, you know, like she's just, her eyes are closed and she's sobbing, and I'm, you know, it's just like kissing, and I have to go. I mean, there, my band's outside waiting for me.
He just came over to me and he kissed me and he said, I love you, Amelia. I'll see you on the other side of this. And I mean, I really think we both thought that that's what was going to happen.
Got in the van, and it was this, I just had the heaviest feeling inside of my body.
And then he left, and then he was gone. And then I was in this house by myself.
It felt so hard to leave, you know? I guess I wish I didn't. But you, what do? You have to go, you know?
The house had become a place that I just did not want to be. I called my best friend at the time, and I just told her, things have gotten so bad that I don't feel like I can keep myself safe. I can't be here, and I don't have anywhere to go. Will you please come pick me up? And then Brian called me. He was just coming unglued on the phone, screaming sadness at me. And I just said, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you right now. I'm trying to get out of this house. I'm getting out tonight. I have to. And I'll talk to you in a couple of days. And then I got off the phone, and my friend and I went outside and smoked a cigarette on the back porch. We put our cigarettes out in an ashtray that was sitting on the arm of a chair. And then we walked back inside, and I looked at her and I said, all right, just help me get out of here without burning this house down. We went over to Rooster, who was sitting on the couch. I sat next to her and I was petting her, and I was like, okay, Rooster, I'm really sorry to do this to you, but I gotta get out of here. I can't be here anymore. It's not healthy for me. I'm sorry that I'm leaving. I'm sorry that Brian's always leaving. I'm sorry that this place feels like hell, but I just have to go, and I love you. And then we just walked out the front door, and my best friend looked at me and said, "It's weird that you just said that thing about fire, because it totally smells like fire out here." And I was like, huh. And then we just left.
When, you know, when somebody calls you early in the morning like that, you know something's up.
I looked at my phone at 7 a.m. and there were 6 missed calls from Brian's twin brother, Nathan. And I just immediately knew that the house had burned down.
You just said, "Brian?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Everything's gone." And he said, "Everything's gone. Your house burned down."
And I called him, and all I heard were just sirens and screams, and he was just screaming, "You're alive, you're alive. You have to come here, everything's gone."
Did you know that Amelia was okay?
Oh yeah, he didn't call me before. He knew she was okay, because he thought she was dead. And, you know, my cat too, he was trying to find Rooster, so.
I mean, I got there, and they were like, I immediately was approached by the arson investigator.
They can't find Rooster.
And they had pen drawing of the house.
And I remember just kind of putting my hand on my abdomen and saying her name.
They were like, "We need to talk to you about some stuff." And I was like, "Am I going to go to jail if I did this?" And they were like, "No." I was like, "All right, why don't you show us on this drawing exactly where you smoked and where you put the cigarette out?"
Her too. You know what I mean? Kind of like, really? Everything and her.
It was just like this long, slow burn that lasted all night, and then it was finally just like consumed in a blaze.
What a way to go.
All my dresses, all my grandmother's dresses, every photograph I've ever taken, every love letter, all of the evidence that I had ever existed.
None of it meant anything to me, like the possessions and the stuff. Like, I didn't care about it, it was gone. As hard as that was, there was also something kind of like liberating about it. I had a firebox in the back bedroom and I asked her to get that. I think this is when she really started crying, and then they came out with it, whatever. I don't know, it seemed like a minute later, but it was probably 15 minutes later, because we were talking, and then she just started sobbing, and all she kept saying was, "They have it, they have it."
There was his like locked box that had the Catcher in the Rye in it,
and there was a lot of joy and elation in her, you know what I mean? Like, she felt like we got something out of the fire, you know what I mean? Like, something came out, like.
So when you come back, you end up getting some money from the insurance that you have.
$70,000.
So what did you do?
I traveled. I took off. At first, I begged Amelia to come with me.
I was like, "We can't get back together. We're not, like, we're not supposed to. Not right now. Maybe not ever. And I think it's going to be really hard not to just, like, fall into each other's arms, because we love each other and we've just gone through something that is so unique and so isolating that, like, how are we supposed to not lean on each other right now, you know?"
And she decided she didn't want to do that. She wanted her, she had her own path, her own road to go down. And so I went to Asia.
I just, like, drove around with a rotating cast of characters to different places collecting things that people were giving me.
Nobody there knew my house burned down. Nobody there knew I had just broken up with in a 6-year relationship. Like, nobody knew me. And that's why I had to leave. I mean, everybody here that I knew
bands were playing shows, and like everywhere I'd ever worked was like doing a clothing drive.
So I had to leave. I wanted to leave and go somewhere and just breathe and walk, be really, really slow, be very intentional.
And then it was like, well, I need garbage cans, we'll keep this box. I need a shower curtain.
I didn't need a couch, I needed time, you know? I didn't need a new house, I needed time.
Simultaneously, along with this just like crushing, interrelated, like huge dark cloud of bad feelings, I was just being like lifted through it by humanity in this way that like it was completely transformative. It made me feel like connected to other people in a way that I totally took with me, you know? And it made me feel so lucky.
I remember being in Burma and I'd wake up and I'd just sit on this like log on the Bay of Bengal, looking at this green, beautiful green ocean alone and just crying and thinking about her and wanting her to be there so bad with me. I didn't understand why I was there alone.
How is your relationship to physical possessions different now?
I have ghost things that I like sometimes, like even today, I'll be like, oh, I want to hear this record. And I'll go over and start looking for it. I'm like, oh yeah, old record collection.
I mean, I think that it really just made me certain of just the ephemeral nature of all things, whether it's a love affair that you think is going to last your whole life or an article of clothing or whatever. I mean, I'm not trying to say that it made me totally not materialistic, but I haven't lost anything since then that I've thought about the next day.
I'm just now, in the last like 3 months, getting to where I'm settling into a home.
Just in the last 3 months?
Yep. That's how long it's taken me. Like I really, for a long time, just was like, I don't need anything and I can live like this forever. And then when I did like get an apartment, I bought one bowl, you know, two coffee cups, one coffee maker. Now I have a coffee cup collection, you know, and a lot of forks.
Is there anything that you're glad burned?
I mean, kind of everything.
Yeah, all of it.
Because my life couldn't ever look the way it does without all of that getting erased, and I really like my life.
I don't have to ever move it again. I don't have to ever pack it. I don't ever have to worry about it.
And I really like the person that I am because this happened to me.
So you and Amelia are still really close.
Yeah.
I mean, we're like best friends.
To me, I had to bring her closer and closer to me because it was, what a horrible thing to feel, you know? How gnarly is that?
It's like, if you can get through that with somebody, it's just not on the table that we would ever not be close.
Because we know each other so well. I mean, so intimately, you know? Like, when you spend 6 years with somebody like that, like, you build something pretty special. Or we did, at least.
You know, I think that it would be really easy to have something like this happen and live scared because of it, you know? But I think that the opposite thing happened to both of us, and that's really beautiful.
All right, that's all I got.
Cool.
So, Arwen, how did you feel hearing that story now, some months later here?
There is a part of me that I think will always be in love with both Amelia and Brian because of how vulnerable they were with me in that piece. It gave me hope in a way that I didn't know I needed it before. I also want to just give a special thank you to you, Gabriel, and you, Kevin, for your patience while I was working on that piece, and an enormous thank you to the owner of my heart, Jen T. Champion, for the music that she let me use in the piece. So thanks, Jen.
And also probably some patience as well.
Yeah, a fair amount.
We also thank Jen for her patience.
Coming up.
Yes?
Kevin's story.
Yeah, well, so I'm thinking that we might want to call this show just TMI. Right? That sort of seems like it's the thread. Well, I mean, we're about to take that to a new level here, too, because we're going to bring you into the storytelling process. And in fact, we're going to tell you the tale of a major fail. It's coming up on Sound Effect, so
don't go away.
Thank you. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm here with a couple of my bandmates. We are talking about some of our very favorite stories of the year. That includes senior producer Arwin Nix.
Hello.
And producer Kevin Kniestad.
My liege.
So, thank you. This is your story, Kevin. And
yes.
Here in the office, it's acquired the nickname of Kevin Fails. And maybe you can just explain.
So, hold on a second. I just kind of want to take the talking stick for a second to talk into the story for a minute. Kevin pitched this story, the original story, what the story was supposed to be, basically when the show first got started, and he couldn't accomplish it. But he also, and this is something I really love about working with Kevin, he knew it was a good idea and he didn't let it go. He wouldn't just move on. And so he would come back every few weeks like, well, what if we do it this way? What if we do it this way? And then finally, one day, he actually closed the door in the sound effect office and he said, no, let's figure this out now. So trapped, we sat there with enormous
cornered
pieces,
yes,
of paper, and we mapped out what we lovingly call Kevin Fails. And I think you like the way it turned out.
I think I love the way it turned out. I mean, maybe not so much the results in the story, but I think the end product is probably one of my favorite things I've ever done.
Yeah. Mine too. All right, stick around for that. And just a quick program note, you're about to hear the three of us transported back in time talking in this exact same room. So present day right now, ending past beginning. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about Lost.
Hello, Gabriel.
Hey, Gabe.
Hello, Kevin Kniestad, producer of Sound Effect. Arwin Nix, senior producer of Sound Effect. What are you guys doing here?
Gabriel, I had the perfect story for this Lost and Found show, but Arwin told me that I ruined it.
I told him that because he did ruin it.
I didn't ruin it. It just didn't quite turn out as I imagined.
You ruined it.
Okay, kids, this is public radio. We are not comfortable with people disagreeing. Okay, let's just get along here for a moment. We've got a few minutes. Why don't you just tell us what you had in mind, Kevin? What would it have been like if this had worked out? Would that be okay with you, Arwin?
I guess it's fine.
Thank you, Gabriel. So back in November, I was out with a friend at this bar in Magnolia, and they had karaoke going on that night. And it was pretty much what you might expect on stage for karaoke. Some singers were okay, some singers were maybe less than okay, and then 1:30 in the morning rolls around, and me and my friend had paid our bill, and we're getting ready to leave, and then this woman goes on stage. And what you typically expect, or at least what I typically expect at 1:30 in the morning from people doing karaoke, is something like this. But it was nothing like that at all. In fact, she didn't even sing. She rapped to a really, really hard, fast Macklemore song. And she freaking killed it. It was really, really impressive, and the whole bar was watching.
And she was cute.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know. I mean, who really pays attention to that kind of stuff?
You actually pay more attention to that stuff than anyone else I know, Kevin.
Well, whatever. But it was more the fact that I had never seen someone go up on stage and own a rap song like this. And I didn't know if I was ever going to see karaoke like this again.
So what did you do?
He did nothing.
Nothing? Come on, Kevin. You must have at least, like, shook her hand or something or told her good job.
No. But... Fast forward a couple of months, the sound effect team is having their weekly show meeting. And we decide we're going to do a show on Lost and Found. And I come up with this fantastic idea. What if we do a Lost and Found story on me trying to find this karaoke unicorn? Like I said, this performance, at least to me, was kind of an anomaly. And I had nothing to go on other than where I saw her, a vague recollection of what she looked like, and the song that she did, not even a name.
Ah, it's a detective story.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I could record the whole process. I'd talk to the staff at the bar.
Well, no, don't ring a bell. Don't recall ever seeing a performance like that before. You sure you didn't just imagine her?
I'd ask the karaoke guy.
Yeah, I remember that. Don't know who she was, though. Never saw her in my life before that night.
We'd have the story of this whole gumshoe trek of solving this karaoke mystery.
And at the end, Kevin would ask her if she wanted to have coffee.
Would I? I mean, it was kind of all about
you
the performance
oh my God,
for
oh
me.
My God, okay.
Anyway, it never got off the ground.
Why not?
Well, the following week, a friend called me who I hadn't heard from in a while, and she was asking me about work, and I was telling her about this story.
You just told me that you saw a girl at a bar do karaoke, and you wanted to find her, and you knew nothing about her.
Do you remember any details that I gave you about her at all?
She was blonde. She was my age, approximately, and she might have been wearing jeans. And the name of the bar.
And what did you say to me?
I said, I can find her.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, first I went on Facebook, and I went to the bar's Facebook. I looked through pictures and found a couple people, and I sent you one girl, and you said that she was older than the girl that you saw. So then I was done with Facebook, and I went on Instagram, and I started searching anyone that was tagged at that bar or posted pictures at that bar. After a while, I found a picture of a, like, the paper that you get when you sign up for your song. So it had two names. So then I figured out who those girls were, and one of them I sent to you, and it was the right one.
Would you, how long do you think this took in total? How much time?
45 minutes I had found her.
45 minutes?
Yeah.
I gave you an approximate age, a hair color, the name of the bar, and that she might have been wearing jeans.
Yes.
So it took you 45 minutes.
I just found a blonde girl that looked about my age and had been to that bar, and she seemed like she sang karaoke regularly, and it was her.
So Monday morning rolls around, and I go into work, and I tell Arwin this story, and Arwin politely points out that now there is no story. There is no gumshoeing, there is no detective work to be done, because it all really took someone with slightly advanced social media skills and about 45 minutes of free time, and that just doesn't make for the most interesting radio story. That was fail number one on my part.
But you guys actually found her. That's something. That's a place
to
start.
He didn't find her. Let's just be clear. He ruined it.
Right. Thank you, Arwin. And after all of this, I at least wanted to share this story with her and ask her about her karaoke performance. So through my very basic social media skills, I sent her a message, sheepishly gave her the Cliff Notes version of the story, and she agreed to talk to me on the phone about it. That's where fail number two comes in. Turns out this wasn't some one-time magical performance that she had blessed an audience with. This is kind of thing all the time.
My go-to is Shoop. I like to do Eminem. I'd like to do Montel Jordan. This is how we do it. Sometimes Hot Stepper.
But I don't do it because I think it's super awesome and I'm really good at it. I do it because it's fun and it's a local bar. And usually all the people that are in the audience, typically I know or I've seen them before. So it's a comfortable environment, I guess.
So, Kevin, do you think you would have had the same reaction if she had sung, you know, Salt-N-Pepa instead of Macklemore?
My bill was paid. I was walking out the door. And if I had heard anything average or bad or crappy or even mildly good, I just would have kept walking. But it stopped me in my tracks. Apparently, though, it doesn't always turn out that great.
Yeah, I did it on Saturday, and it was real bad.
Why was it bad?
It was real bad. I would have messed up happy birthday this Saturday. Well, you saw it at 1:30, which is pretty impressive that it was entertaining to you at that point. But this was probably around the same time, and probably a few more alcoholic beverages were involved. So I don't think you would have thought the same thing if you would have seen me last Saturday.
Okay. Well, Kevin, any chance of at least getting that cup of coffee with her?
Gabriel, thank you so much for asking me that.
Well, I mean, at this point, I would say no, being that I'm married, but...
Ooh, fail.
Absolute fail.
Fail. But she was a really good sport. Her husband was a ridiculously good sport, and when it was all said and done, I still think it turned out to be kind of a fun, lost and found story after all. What do you guys think?
I guess it's fine.
I give you an A+ for enthusiasm, Kevin.
Love you guys, too.
Chandler, everybody, the one and only. Some call her better than Macklemore. I don't know about that. I might be a little strong.
Let's go. That story from sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. And Kevin, what is the rest of the story?
Well, believe it or not, I actually saw her do it again.
Was it is amazing?
It was like hearing the karaoke voice of Jesus come down from above. No, it never gets old. I saw her at the same bar, and she was sitting outside, and I said, "You need to do that again." And she said, "No." And I said, "But it's been 6 months." And then she said, "Fine." And she went up and she killed it again. It was great.
See, another story about Kevin not giving up. I think that's the theme of this one. I love it. Kevin, I love that story.
I do too. And you know, for all our talk of Kevin failing, even in the context of the story, you didn't really fail. You just succeeded too quickly.
That's right. I love your outlook on things, Gabe. I will go home tonight and sleep well because I just succeeded too quickly.
There you go. Well, with that, we are going to call it quits on today's show.
Sound effect comes from senior producer Arwin Nix.
And producer Kevin Kniestad.
Our intern, who is not in the room right now, is Warren Langford. And our executive producer and fearless leader is Aaron Hennessy.
We love you, Aaron.
Do you have a favorite segment that we didn't play? We'd love to hear about it. You can post it on our Facebook page or tweet at KPLU and at Gabriel Spitzer, at Arwin with two N's.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
I don't really do Twitter anymore.
Yeah, all right. You can also email soundeffect@kplu.org. And we are on iTunes, of course. Subscribe to our podcast there and rate and review the show. Come on back next week, fresh off your New Year's Eve mayhem, for some stories about trouble with the law.
When I walked into those banks, everything in my body told me to leave and get out of there and not do it.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU. KPLU.